My name is Lynn, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the discussion over responsibility and sovereignty in U.S.-China relations. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there'll be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Megan Smith, you may begin your conference.
Thank you. Good morning. Chinese President Hu arrives in Washington for a state visit next week with hopes high in both capitals that his trip may serve to smooth out the edges of a U.S.-China relationship that has frayed over the past year. Clashes over security, the global economy, and differing political and government values challenge the relationship today. Joining us to talk about what this visit may bring and discuss two new papers on the Sino-U.S. relationship are Nina Hachigian, Kate Gordon, and Adam Hirsch. Nina is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and author of the paper, Conduct Befitting a Great Power, Responsibility and Sovereignty in U.S.-China Relations. She will give a brief review of the Obama administration's policies dealing with China and expand on the paper's discussion of foreign policy expectations between the two countries. Kate is the Vice President for Energy Policy at the Center for American Progress and is nationally recognized for her work on the intersection of clean energy and economic development policy. She'll discuss her paper, Rising to the Challenge, a Progressive U.S. Approach to China's Innovation and Competitiveness Policies. And finally, today we'll hear from Adam, a CAP economist, who will speak to the economics influencing the U.S.-China relationship. He taught macroeconomics and money and banking at UMass Amherst and was a visiting scholar at the Shanghai University of Finance and Economics Institute for Advanced Research. Just a reminder today that by being on the call, your consent to being recorded and the entire call will be recorded. With that, I will turn it over to Nina.
Thanks, Megan, and thanks, everyone, for joining us today. Perhaps the most ambitious goal of the Obama administration for the summit with President Hu next week is to alter the narrative of the relationship. At any given time, the headline, China cooperates with the U.S., and the headline, China clashes with the U.S., will probably both be true. In the same month that we are fighting about rare earths, we are cooperating on Iran, for example. And that's the nature of our frenemy relationship, and often uncomfortable one of deeply interdependent rivals. The headline about clashing generally gets more play, and that was true even before all the incidents last year. But the fact is that in addition to all the acrimony over currency, indigenous innovation, South China Sea claims, North Korea, and others, there have been some real elements of cooperation in the U.S.-China relationship that have been underplayed. For example, on Iran, China joined with the U.S. in passing tough sanctions in the Security Council. And there was also a request by the United States that China not enter into any large new energy deals with Tehran and not to backfill when other foreign investors pulled out. And apparently they are honoring that request. Very recently on North Korea, Beijing has quietly urged Pyongyang to show restraint, which seems to be working. And in Cancun, China finally agreed to have its emissions be internationally verifiable, and that's a very big deal. I've also just read this week that the Consumer Product Safety Commission is opening an office in Beijing, and because 90% of the toys in the U.S. come from China, that's another important area of cooperation. So the hope is that this visit can help accentuate the positive, as that old song goes, and sketch a more realistic picture of the entire relationship. And the reason that's so important is because a negative narrative can really feed on itself and create its own reality by strengthening hardliners in China and in the U.S., who can then take the relationship into an even more confrontational posture. So other than a more balanced narrative, what is success from a U.S. point of view? I think that there'll be incremental progress on a number of issues. This is not going to be a sweeping, future-looking summit, but more work-a-day. So some of these deliverables, one, as we know, with Secretary Gates in China, will be a resumption of the military-to-military relationship. There may be some announcements on human rights, but Obama will certainly be sure to talk about that issue either way. Perhaps on North Korea, and this is less certain, there will be some indication of a path that will eventually get us back to the six-party talk. And on the economic front, which Adam will cover, we can expect some announcements about more protection for IPR, for intellectual property, and perhaps an additional statement about not discriminating against foreign investors. And I think that there will also be, alongside the summit, the announcement of some commercial deals that will be expected to create U.S. jobs. But a question is how sustainable a positive tone in the relationship is. There's a number of factors that suggest not very. We've got the overall rising power dynamic, which is hard in the best of times, and these are not the best of times for the United States. And we also have the different geographies, histories, values. But what I focused on in this new report were our different ideas about global responsibility. The Obama administration understands well that issues like climate change and the financial crisis can't be tackled by the U.S. alone, and so there's been a big effort to get major powers to step up and become responsible stakeholders. And this is absolutely the right goal, but there are a number of roadblocks when it comes to China. We don't have the same ideas of what global responsibility means, and we also have different ideas about sovereignty. So let me talk about each of these quickly. First, from a U.S. point of view, there are all kinds of reasons that China should do more to help with global problem solving, starting with the fact that it is a huge beneficiary of the international system that regulates trade and provides stability in all kinds of ways. Second, China contributes to problems like economic imbalances and global warming, so it should also help to solve them. And finally, China has real capacity in the form of lots of cash and talent, especially at a time when regular contributors like the U.S. and Europe are strapped. So Americans think that inviting China to join with the U.S. in solving problems shows that we can accept a strong China as long as it plays by the rules. But to China, all of this sounds like another trap designed to constrain its rise. There is a pretty high level of paranoia in China when it comes to U.S. intentions. So China's official line is that it will continue to accept more and more global responsibilities as it grows. But in fact, there's a lot of debate in China about what China should do and how it will benefit. And moreover, China is still very focused inward on its own domestic problems. Chinese analysts will also argue that China is already being responsible in its own way by, for example, contributing lots of peacekeepers to the UN, but maybe not always in the ways that the U.S. wants. And this debate touches on ideas about national sovereignty, because in many areas, China has now become a systemically important player, not just a stakeholder. The health of the whole system depends on what China does, for example, on climate or on currency. But China feels that its decisions should be its alone, without outside interference from other countries or institutions. And here's where it's interesting, because American neoconservatives are making the same arguments about sovereignty that the Chinese Communist Party is. John Bolton has a new book out in which he argues that when the U.S. engages with international institutions to solve world problems, that is allowing for too much outside interference in our affairs. And that's the same thing that China says, that, for example, the value of its currency should be its decision alone without regard to how it impacts the rest of the world. So, in fact, these both American neoconservatives and China are misguided on this point. It's really key that the U.S. and China adopt modern idea of sovereignty, where we abide by international norms and rules and interact with international organizations, because it benefits Americans and Chinese and everyone else greatly in the form of trade, safe airplane travel, less exposure to lethal viruses, a chance to reduce global warming, etc. So we have different ideas, but they may converge in the long run, especially if we can get through what will be a very politically charged time of the next 2 years. The report goes on to make 10 suggestions for the Obama administration on China policy. I'll mention just one, which is to leverage China's strength to the U.S. advantage. And one way to do that is to encourage Chinese direct investment in the United States that creates American jobs. So I'll conclude by saying that China policy is never simple. The United States shouldn't be overly aggressive and militaristic, because that will only strengthen the voices in China who are most nationalistic and hostile. On the other hand, we can't be conciliatory, because that doesn't get us what we want, and it makes China suspicious. So China policy will continue in this pattern of cooperation and conflict, and the challenge is to always keep both sides in mind. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Now we'll hear from Kate Gordon.
Thanks so much, Megan, and thanks everyone for joining the call. In our paper, Rising to the Challenge, a Progressive U.S. Approach to China's Innovation and Competitiveness Policies, we really tried to get at the question of what will happen during the current clean tech revolution. We've seen the industrial revolution, the high tech revolution. Now we're in the clean tech revolution. And in this paper, we tried to dispel the notion that the United States is inevitably going to be a leader in innovation and technology during the clean tech revolution. In fact, China is consistently investing in the building blocks of innovation, the same kinds of building blocks that the United States invested in to get ourselves to our innovation leadership that we're in today. For instance, China has the fourth highest level of research and development spending in the world of any country and the highest of any developing country, whereas the United States has seen research and development funding fall significantly from its high during the Apollo space program down to about 12% now of our GDP. China has also continued to invest in its manufacturing infrastructure, which has been a huge part of its new innovation expertise. China has seen the relationship between innovation and manufacturing, and the fact that the more design and engineering that you do in a country, the more likely you are to be able to do successive waves of innovation on a technology. In contrast, the United States has let our manufacturing sector decline significantly. It's now making up only about 12% of GDP, down from about 29% at its high point in the 50s. Clean energy presents a real case study for this. On basic research in energy, U.S. government spending has declined significantly at the same time that China's has really advanced. And China now has almost twice the installed capacity of renewable energy that the United States has in absolute terms. China continues to invest in these sectors, continues to invest in infrastructure and manufacturing underpinning clean energy innovation, and it really points out the fact that the United States cannot sit complacently by. We really are in a race that we may not recognize. One way that China has been investing in innovation has been through an interesting strategy that we call an import, assimilate, re-innovate model. What the Chinese government has done is to actively recruit foreign companies to share their technologies with Chinese joint venture partners in exchange for access to the Chinese workforce and marketplace. What that does is to essentially allow Chinese companies to gain access to often U.S. invented cutting-edge technologies, but then build on those technologies with Chinese manufacturing and development and innovation, and to, again, come out with successive waves of innovation. At the moment, there's a question about whether this model will work in the long term. Right now, intellectual property behind 90% of Chinese exports is intellectual property owned by other countries. 90% of the exports were essentially invented elsewhere. But if China continues investing in its own infrastructure, its education and workforce system, and its advanced manufacturing system, this may change. In the paper, we go into a couple of other potential liabilities with China's model, including wasteful spending, bureaucratic inefficiency, academic fraud, some other missteps that China has taken. But ultimately, we conclude that though this is not a zero-sum game, though cooperation in many of these areas is useful, the U.S. does need a strong response to make sure that America stays internationally competitive in innovation in the clean tech sector. We make several specific recommendations to that end, including modernizing basic infrastructure to allow businesses to more effectively compete, investing more in science and math education and workforce development to ensure that we have the workers who are able to participate in developing cutting-edge technologies in the future, developing financing policies to move more public and private capital to innovators and bolster our culture of entrepreneurship by rewarding risk-taking, and by bringing new products and cutting-edge products to market, promoting international trade policies that actually ensure access to foreign markets and the free flow of goods, and honing our research and development policies. So we're investing not just in early-stage basic research, but also in the full innovation lifecycle from invention through production, commercialization, and installation. What we don't want to see in the United States is an economic model that's based on early stage invention that then moves overseas for its entire production cycle and we then buy back to install in this country. That won't add much value to our economy and takes away many of the middle class jobs that have helped anchor our current status as a world leader and a world leader in innovation in particular. These are progressive policies that we feel would boost our national competitiveness and job growth in the short term and ensure that our once dominant position in science, technology, innovation, and entrepreneurship is not eclipsed by China in the 21st century. Again, just a final note, this is not a zero-sum game. There are many places in which the U.S. and China can cooperate on these policies. We're seeing some of that through Department of Energy programs right now on clean energy with intellectual property sharing programs with China. But we do need to take heed and look at the way that China is systematically investing in those same building blocks of innovation that anchored our current economic strength. And I will, with that, turn it over to Adam Hirsch, who's an economist here at CAP.
Thanks, Kate, and thanks, everyone, for the opportunity to talk to you this morning. I'm going to talk about what we can expect to see discussed at the summit between President Obama and President Hu in terms of the economics realm. Nina and Kate have touched on some of the key economics issues that we expect to be debated, including on innovation policy and investment policy. So I'm going to focus on what's happening with the international imbalances in regard to China, China's undervalued exchange rate, and China's efforts to move to a more domestic demand-led economic growth model. And more than just talk about what we can expect to see discussed at the summit, as an economist who's lived and worked in China and lived and worked in Washington, D.C., I want to offer you a trans-Pacific perspective on the issues and what I'll be looking for in the meeting as signs of making progress on these issues. Now, the narrative that we often see in stories on China's exchange rate is that there's some zero-sum conflict between the U.S. and China over the exchange rate, and that the issue provides a convenient scapegoat for politicians to blame China for the economic woes we're experiencing here in the United States: slow economic growth, high unemployment, stagnant middle-class incomes. But I think it's critical to recognize that China's undervalued exchange rate is creating serious problems for a lot of countries in the global economy, including perhaps foremost for China's economy. When I talk to contacts, Chinese economists in China, including people who have responsibility for managing the pace of economic growth in China, what I hear is that they're really concerned about the undervalued exchange rate, in that the policy is creating inflationary pressures in China, it's creating pressures of a real estate bubble, and is creating pressures that could reignite China's stock market bubble. We saw this morning with an announcement from China's central bank as it continues to try to struggle to contain high inflation. These are problems for the Chinese economy that China is less well-equipped to deal with, less predictable than any threats to employment or economic stability that might come from the employment side if China were to revalue its exchange rate. In addition to the concerns I hear from Chinese economists, I'd add that China's undervalued exchange rate policy is very costly for China in social terms. China has spent over $2.6 trillion keeping its exchange rate undervalued. By the way, that's about half, a little more than half of China's GDP last year. And that money is money that could be spent on a lot better things for China and for China's citizens, like creating a social security system, providing health care and education for its citizens, making other kinds of investments that will help create the jobs and ease China's transition to an economy led by more domestic demand-led growth. Now, China has been doing a lot on the exchange rate front. The exchange rate has been appreciating in recent years. In real terms, the exchange rate is up almost 6% since 2008. And China has been working to start allowing offshore use of the renminbi. But this is not happening fast enough to reverse the imbalances, and it's not happening fast enough to stop the destabilizing effects of inflation and bubble economy pressures that China is experiencing. So China has real incentives of its own to start addressing this problem and to move a lot faster and addressing the imbalances in the undervalued exchange rate than it has been. The narrative we often see from politicians in the U.S. and in the press here is to scapegoat China on the exchange rate. And this may play well in our domestic politics, but it erects a rhetorical barrier to making progress on the issue. No one likes to be bullied, and appearing bullied forces China's leaders to take a strong posture to play to their domestic audience. As Nina talked about, this kind of posturing helps strengthen China's hardline nationalists and gets in the way of making progress on issues of mutual interest. What I'll be looking for coming out of the summit between President Obama and President Hu, signs of progress on the exchange rate and the international imbalances, is whether President Obama can make the case why revaluation is in China's interest to President Hu. We'll know this is happening if we hear coming out of the meeting talk not about the level of exchange rate or commitments about the pace of change, but about how China is working on its imbalances and how China is working to move towards a more domestic-oriented economy. The United States has an important role to play here, too. We can help by creating an environment that makes it easier for China to invest and broaden the United States. Getting some of that money out of China and into our economy will help alleviate the put upward pressure on China's exchange rate. So the other sign I'll be looking for coming out of the meeting is if President Obama and President Hu can talk about creating a transparent environment and establishing principles for welcoming job-creating investment from China and the United States. Thank you.
Thanks, Adam. And with that, we'll open the floor to questions. Just a quick reminder that if you would like to take a look at the papers that Nina and Kate have authored, they're available today at www.americanprogress.org. Operator, please open the floor.
As a reminder to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. We'll pause for a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from Paul Maroli with Energy Intelligence.
Hi, this is a question for, I guess, Nina. You had mentioned that more foreign investment by the Chinese in the United States was one of your recommendations. I was wondering how that could relate to the energy sector, given as oil and gas are viewed as strategic assets by the United States, and the U.S. government actually blocked a deal by a Chinese company to buy a U.S. independent producer called Unocal about 5 years ago. Have things changed politically there?
I think it's the recommendation of the paper that we try to encourage Chinese investment that creates jobs and to make the process by which we evaluate deals that have national security implications very transparent and as clear as possible to the Chinese. I mean, I think that the environment has changed somewhat in the sense that, you know, we're facing very high unemployment and a pretty slow growth economy right now. And I think that most Americans would welcome a job created by a Chinese company so long as, you know, that there weren't national security implications. And as Adam pointed out, it would help the Chinese as well. So, you know, there are going to be investments that are politically sensitive, but there should be plenty that are not.
Just to add on to that, go ahead, Nina.
No, I was just going to say I turn it over to you for particularly the energy.
Just to add on to that in the energy space, I think that there are, and thanks for the question, Paul, I think there are three areas where we may see some interesting investment from China in the energy space in the United States. One of which is very positive, two of which I think present more problems. The first is investments in Chinese companies coming to the U.S. and investing here by building manufacturing capabilities. We're seeing that with electric cars to some extent. We're seeing that with wind and solar to some extent. And those investments are pretty much just only positive. I mean, those are job-creating investments in the United States. We're seeing real manufacturing jobs come out of that, also assembly jobs in a number of places. The second category, and I expect to see some of this from the delegation coming with President Hu, is investments in buying American companies that have not yet licensed their technology. One thing we've been seeing in the energy space is a lot of outreach to labs to try to buy technology before the technology has been licensed and get the technology to move whole scale to China for licensing and development. That's a little more problematic because if that happens, we have the few lab jobs at the beginning of a process, but we lose the rest of the production process and development process to another country. I think that's something to watch. And the third area goes to your question. The third area we're really expecting to see movement is the question of Chinese investment in coal. China's become a net coal importer, mostly from Australia, a little bit from a couple of other countries. But there's a big question of whether as the U.S. coal consumption starts to decline, as it is doing because of the rise of natural gas and because of regulations on coal, whether we'll see Chinese investments in coal mining for export to China. That's become a big issue, especially in Alaska, where there's a lot of coal underground that is not yet being mined. That's a very interesting question for the United States and potentially a big environmental issue because it could dramatically expand mining in the U.S.
I would add to that from an economic perspective and walking the line between the economics and the national security issues raised by the prospects of China's investment in the United States, that I think Nina is talking about in the policy that we're looking at is to be able to lay out a set of principles about what kinds of investments that we should accept in the United States, to create clear expectations and understanding of what kinds of investments China can be making in the United States. And that requires in the United States to have a conversation about what are the kinds of things that we want to keep off the table and want to erect a fence around for national security interests. But right now, those are unknown, and so just the uncertainty and the expectations of what political problems that Chinese companies might run into trying to invest in the United States is an impediment to the investment. Now, on the other side of the table, U.S. companies investing in China have fairly clear expectations about what the limits and expectations of their activities in China can be. They may not always like the terms of those, but they know what to expect when they come in, and that's conducive to investment. If we're going to invite Chinese investment into our economy, we need to do the same thing.
Great. Thanks, Beth.
Operator, are there any other questions?
As a reminder, to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from Doug Obie with Inside EPA.
Hi, thanks for taking this. I just had a quick question. Right at the beginning of the call, there was mention of the fact that there might be some more announcements related to protection of intellectual property rights, and I was just trying to get a little more detail on that. Thanks.
I actually don't have more detail. That's as much as I know. I mean, as of a couple of days ago, it was still, you know, there were a bunch of American officials still over there negotiating, so I don't have any final say from anybody about what's going to happen.
Okay, fair point. Thanks.
Okay. Again, to ask a question, please press star one. There are no further questions.
We're just going to wait one more second and see if anyone else has a question. Okay, with that, I thank everyone for participating today. If you have any follow-up questions, feel free to email me at msmith, that's M as in Megan, Smith, at americanprogress.org. And as I said earlier, the two new reports on China and U.S. relations can be found at www.americanprogress.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect.